Okay, we'll call the meeting order. You guys are remarkably well behaved and quiet today. Not sure if that's a good sign or a bad sign. Good morning. We have one item on the agenda before we start with minutes.
Madam Chair, I am happy to make a statement. I think it's important for us to recognize that it's the last meeting that Steve Rodman will be joining us as an ex officio member, and we ought to recognize that and thank him for his work. There's a lot that you contributed that I was not present for, but for the parts that I've been present, I'm certainly grateful for your service to the state and to this group. I'm sure others would echo that, but certainly want to recognize that publicly and acknowledge your contribution and wish you well in your next adventure. So, thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your service. Okay, moving on to item number one, review and approval of minutes. I had one comment to the minutes and one suggested clarification. We had approved the changes to the investment policies with a proviso to take out, I think, Section 3A. And I would like to propose amending the minutes to specifically refer to that section so that it's clear. I'm reading. Would you guys be okay with that addition to the minutes? Any other changes or additions to the minutes?
I'm trying to move approval of the minutes as amended by your suggestion.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Wonderful. Moving on, item number two, meeting dates for 2018-19. The August date is set for August 8th. That's the original date that we had. I will not be here for that meeting, but Mr. Russell will take control of the wheel for that day. And we have the 2019 meeting dates set. John, do you need us to approve anything? Or just
the 19th.
The 19 dates, okay. All those, oh, do I have a motion for the approval of the 2019 meeting dates?
I'm sure so moved.
Second.
In favor?
Aye.
Where's that, John?
Good morning. John Sherwin, Investment Division Director, Chief Investment Officer, with committee reports and opening remarks. Only one investment to report on since the OIC last convened on committee investment. Am I as loud as it seems?
Yeah.
The Private Equity Committee met on March 22nd. And at that time approved a $200 million commitment to KSL Capital Partners 5. That's all on the committee front. Let's talk about today's show. We've got policy updates. So a piece of legislation last year, ORS 293.712, established both training and continuing education requirements for the council. And we introduced some policy, I think at the end of last year, that took care of the fiduciary training element. And today we're coming back to finish compliance with that piece of legislation by proposing continuing education parameters for the council. So Jim Pete will come up later and join me, and we'll talk about that. And then the other policy item would be to increase the approval ceilings at the committee level for alternatives in the opportunity portfolio, and that's just consistent with what we did last meeting for private equity and real estate. Alternatives portfolio review. Ben's going to come up and talk about what he and Mike and now Paul have been up to over the last year, and I think you'll hear him say we're about halfway through fifth inning in terms of AUM, but the maturity of the portfolio is still quite young. I think an average age of 2 to 3 years, so hard to draw conclusions in terms of performance and correlation with the other asset classes, but making really good progress on money in the ground. And you'll also hear him say that there are plenty of things to look at. So lots of pitches come on our way there. And we're excited to have Paul Koch join the team. And we're also underway in recruitment for a fourth team member for alternatives. So really exciting stuff going on in that world. April, of course, is strategic asset allocation and CMA updates. And I want to just remind the council that this comes at you once a year, but it comes at you in different levels. So every 4 years or so, it comes at you in what I would say the most rigorous level, and that would be in the form of an asset liability study. And I would suggest to you that's probably certainly the most rigorous and probably the most important, because that's the time where we take a step back and look at the liability side, look at any changes on the liability side, and then determine whether or not we need to make corresponding changes on the asset side. This is not that year. The second level would be those years in which the conversation at this council and any conclusions that it draws help inform the work of the PERS board. This is not that year either. That was last year. So this is, in some senses, the most benign of the three levels. This is just an update of our existing targets and consultants coming forward to share with us their updated assumptions regarding capital market returns. And as you've heard me describe, that's a rather mechanical process that produces a nominal return artifact. And the nominal return is far less important than the relationship between the asset classes, what I'll refer to as the relative returns. Because if there's meaningful changes in those relative returns, that would suggest a change in asset allocation. And this year, we don't have neither an asset allocation proposal to present, nor do we have meaningful changes in the relative returns. So consequently, this is really the most benign of all asset allocation scenarios where we have no changes. Hopefully that will not discourage any questions. So we'll have Janet and Alan come up and share their respective firms' view of the world. And then finally, we've got the asset, the annual review for SAFE. I don't expect there to be any changes other than maybe a preview of coming attractions, because they are embarking on an asset liability study. And so maybe this time next year there will be an asset allocation proposal. But I'll let them talk about that. So that's the preview. Anything for me before we get started?
Just a comment. It's a good thing that this is a benign time period, given the changes in the PERS board. So it couldn't happen at a better time.
Mm-hmm. That's true. All right, if there's nothing else for me, I'll invite Jen Pete up, and we'll go through the policy changes.
Good morning, Jen.
So as I just described, is it the first? I don't have the book in front of me. This is the continuing ed piece first?
Second.
Okay, so the first part would be to harmonize the approval ceilings at the alternatives and opportunity portfolio committees, harmonize that with what we approved last meeting for private equity and real estate. And just to remind you, this would be to raise first-time commitments to $250 million and re-ups to $350
million. No other substantive changes, right, John?
No.
Okay. Any
other than removing that one substitution clause that we identified last time.
Same proviso. John, did I see your hand there?
Yeah. It's something I've talked about with Rekhaya. I'm comfortable increasing the ceiling levels, but this is a ton of money, and typically it requires only one member of the OIC to be present. And I believe that given the magnitude of these funds, we should have a requirement that two OIC members be present. Just makes it that much more transparent. These are phone meetings typically. I don't think it's a terrible thing, but we obviously have to prepare for it. But I think it just gives people more confidence that, given the magnitude of the money, that things are being looked at.
So my opinion in response to that is that we have to think about it carefully, because adding another OIC member would make the committees four, and so you have to think about whether an even number is good, bad, or indifferent. But also remind Member Russell and the rest of the council that the committees are the purview of the treasurer, and so we'll have to engage him in a separate conversation about how big you want these to be.
John, isn't it true that if there's a dissenting vote on the committee, it goes to the council anyway? So the odd number, I don't think, makes that much difference, does it?
That's true. It's also not automatic. So a dissenting vote could kill the proposal altogether, or it could
jump it up.
So, John, when we agreed to the increase in the thresholds for approval, the one contingency was that we would revisit the committee structure and the governance system around that. If those committees are Treasurer Reed's committees, then what we can do, we said that we would set a specific time on the calendar this year to do that. I think we identified November, John, as the time. Just circle back to that. Is that right? Yes.
I don't remember.
That's good. All right. So if we assign November, then I think Treasurer Reed, I think together with John, maybe we can have some conversations or structure the conversation about the kind of governance belts and suspenders we'll need for higher approval thresholds. Does November sound reasonable to you?
It does sound reasonable. I also don't remember the specifics, but I think that's a reasonable time to consider and think about it. And I appreciate the way you said that, because I think it is more than just the number of OIC members, though that's a meritorious topic to talk about. It's also about larger issues of accessibility and how those who are interested in it can participate.
Transparency,
notice.
Yeah, so John, you volunteered to be our leader, our fearless leader in that.
Did I?
Yes, we'll look forward to hearing from you in November.
Like the Army.
Yes, you've been voluntold to lead us on that. So I think if we can get that done before the December meeting, it sooner would be better, but I just want to make sure you have enough time. So let's just say by the November meeting.
Yeah.
Is that okay with the rest of the board members? Okay.
I have one question about polls. We're talking about 702, right? Is that the one we're on right now?
Are we on 702?
And, yes.
And 701. Okay. So this is just a quick question. Section 3, Part E, it says that if the Office of State Treasurer objects to the proposed investment or is advised by any OIC member that he or she objects to the proposed investment, the investment will essentially be canceled. Is that the member of the committee that this is speaking to, or is this any member of the council that can object to a proposed investment? So it's basically any member of the council has veto power over any investment decision?
Any member can bring a proposal from the committee level up to the full council.
Okay, so this is not speaking directly to a proposed investment then?
So you all receive all the committee material, even though only one of you participates in each of the committee meetings. However, upon receipt, any one of you can ask that the proposal come from the committee to the full council.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions on the policy? Do you want us to approve Stephen serially,
yes,
or individually or together?
I think they could be done as a package.
The memo's written as a package. I was wondering if you have questions about the education policy, we might separate them, approve the two committee policies, then discuss the education policy.
That sounds good. Any other comments on the committee policies? Do I have a motion to approve staff recommended policy changes?
So moved.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, so 701 and the other one is approved.
702 and 703.
Okay.
Alternatives and opportunity.
So then what is the number for the educational requirement? Is that 701?
It's not yet numbered.
Okay.
Because it's a new policy.
Okay. Okay, so the policy there is you voluntold me to to help the board get the educational requirements that are set forth in the policy. Basic fiduciary overview and then continuing education.
Yeah, we differentiated between the initial training that you all have already completed with ongoing, and there are numerous conference seminar opportunities throughout the year to satisfy the continuing ed piece. And so I'll support the chair in assembling a list of what I consider the best and give you all plenty of notice so you can plan accordingly.
Simple enough. You ready for a motion?
I'm ready.
Madam Chair, I would move approval of the recommendation.
I second.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, we go to school. Twice
good.
A year. So moving on to item number 5. Carl, you are up.
So I'll just provide a quick introduction before turning over to the consultant presentation. As discussed earlier in the CIO's opening remarks, this is the annual capital markets assumption update. There are two components that feed into the expected returns, the asset allocation and the capital market assumptions. The asset allocation has not changed since 2015 when the council last had a reviewed a very robust analysis by Callan Associates. And so the asset allocation has remained fixed since 2015. And the second component are the capital market assumptions, which are generated solely by Callan Associates, the council's general consultant. Those capital market assumptions have remained the same as well versus the previous year, I guess to steal some Callan's thunder. So the fact that the asset allocation remained unchanged and the capital market assumptions remain the same, that result in an expected return that remains at 7.1%, which the council had also reviewed last year. So with that out of the way, I'll just turn it over to Callan Associates.
And PCA.
And PCA, right. Sorry.
Hey, Carl, will you stay up on
yes.
the dais with him? Wonderful. Good morning, Janet. I'm sure this is the first time in a long time that it's been sunnier here than where you.
Yeah, it's not from yesterday morning when I left, so it's beautiful here when I arrived.
Welcome.
So for the record, Janet Becker-Wold, Callan Associates, and thank you again. So John gave a great introduction in terms of the purpose and intent of this presentation today. We do this regularly for clients where we just sort of benchmark against market conditions, your asset allocation, so we have no recommendations and we have no changes in our capital markets expectations, but we do have a brief presentation which I'll go through and hopefully highlight a couple of things. So, this page here, there we go. Thank you. So we thought we'd start out with just a brief reminder of modern portfolio theory and how risk kind of plays into this, because risk is one of the things that we have the highest confidence in terms of our projections. Returns, as you know, are very uncertain. So we want to look at risk, and the way we define things, the way we look at percentiles and everything else, and the way we communicate the risk of your asset allocation is really based on this somewhat normal-looking curve. And we know that returns are not normally distributed, but this is our best estimate of how we can look at variability. So if you look at this, you can see that if you look at the yellow line in the middle, what we've shown you here is an example of a domestic equity, our domestic equity expectations. This is our current expectation, but just an example.
An expected return of 8, so that's the middle, that's the average. And then we looked at the volatility being 18%, just as an example. So you can see with that volatility, it gives you a range of distribution of possible outcomes based on those two assumptions, the return and the associated standard deviation. So standard deviation is positive and negative, so you can have a better outcome or you can have a worse outcome. So standard deviation captures the full range of returns. So with about a two-thirds probability you capture, you can see how much of that curve you capture. When you go out to 95.5, you get more, and if you go out to 99.7, you capture most of the curve. So if you had a two standard deviation event for a U.S. equity portfolio with those characteristics, you could have a return of minus 36%, which would be within normal range. So just to make sure you understand that variability is defined on both positive and negative outcomes.
Janet, this is risk for dummies, I realize, but how did you arrive at 18%? What's the significance of that?
There's no significance. This is just an example. It was just an illustration of how...
What you're talking about is relationship to volatility. Is that the case?
That's the same. So we use those terms interchangeably. So we...
Well, I read the newspaper that volatility has been benign in the last 6 months. It's increasing, and so this is volatility is headline news in the paper,
exactly,
implying that it's changing dramatically.
Right. So when you read about the headline, when they talk about volatility in the markets, they're usually referring to an index called the VIX index,
right,
which is a measure of the volatility of the S&P 500. And generally, it's a very short-term measure. So when all the headlines last year were basically saying the S&P 500 volatility as measured by the VIX index was very low, and it was historically very low.
Right.
But now we're kind of seeing that come back to a more, what would be considered a more normal volatility. When we look at this, this is saying in a specific asset class, what is the expectation for a return, that would be an average return looking forward, and the associated range of returns around that. So what all we're trying to say here is that this is all about probabilities and probability distributions. So when we get to your asset allocation, you're going to see that there's a range around our 7.1, which appears to be very precise, but there's a range around that. It's a reasonable expectation for the variability in those returns.
And that range would be extended in the case of higher volatility.
Exactly, and I'm hopefully to illustrate that for you in this presentation.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so this is really, I just like this chart because it shows the actual returns for calendar years in a histogram format. And what you can see is it's not exactly normally distributed, but there are a cluster of returns in the center, and the frequency of the more extreme returns is less, so it generally follows the shape of a normal distribution. But what you can see is what we've seen lately, which is the ones highlighted in green, which are the 16, 14, 12, and 10-year returns, have all been very strong. And as you know, we had a very strong 2017 return of 21.8. So the markets have been very strong. And you can see here how extreme 2008 really was in terms of its spot on this histogram there off to the left and highlighted in red. But that was within expectations of the variability we would expect from markets, even though it was very extreme. So again, John talked a little bit about this, and we wanted to highlight that this is a capital market, a rough estimate of the capital market line. And what it is intended to show is the lowest risk asset class on the far left, and risk is on the bottom, is on the horizontal axis, and expected returns on the vertical axis. So as you move out in risk, our expectation and the way we construct our capital markets expectation and the way PCA does it and everybody does it is that we assume that there is a risk premium and a return premium to assuming more risk. That's kind of a fundamental underpinning of development of capital markets expectations. So cash is the bookend on the left, and private equity is the bookend on the right. So you can see that in between, you have a whole range of things, but they generally follow that more risk, more return framework. Right? So you're either a lender or you're an owner, and other asset classes are generally combinations of the two. So getting to our
on that, Is there some implication of the importance of being below or above the line? You're below the line?
No. It's meant to show the trend on from less risk to more risk and the expected premium from a return perspective of those.
But looking at commodities, it looks like it has a relatively high risk and a low return. Is that the case?
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that that's not a desirable asset class, because the dimension that we're not including here is the correlation. And that's another really important component of capital markets expectations.
Okay.
So it's not to imply that you should be in or out of any of these. It's just to show in a very general format what our expectations are in terms of compensation for risk. And it's just a basic building block of the capital markets assumptions. We assume this relationship. So on page 4, we look at our capital markets expectations as a 10-year forward-looking expectation. And we highlighted in green the asset classes that we've included that the council invests in. So global equity, fixed income, real assets, which includes your primarily the real estate portfolio, private equity, and diversified strategies. For the most part, for global equity and U.S. fixed income, we use Cowen's capital markets assumptions. For real assets and private equity, we use customized expectations, given the tenure that the council has investing in these two asset classes and the uniqueness of some of your strategies. We've made some modifications that we think are reasonable to our expectations to accommodate your experience to some extent investing in these asset classes over very long periods of time. So they haven't changed. As we mentioned, our expectations haven't changed. Your custom expectations have not changed from 2017 to 2018. That is not to say that we didn't do the work to come to that conclusion. We went through the normal analysis that we do and came to the conclusion that we did not see a material change in anything in 2017 that would change our view on a 10-year forward look.
Janet, I'm struggling to understand one of the bullets on page 8 of your deck. It reads, OIC private equity excess return over the S&P was lowered to 2.75 from 4.8. So I'm trying to understand the statement you just made, which is that there aren't any changes, but this second change, will you help me understand how they work?
Yeah, I apologize. That second bullet point is a little confusing. So let me walk you through how we developed the assumption last year for the customized OIC numbers. We have a 12.5% arithmetic return for private equity, our standard assumption. Mm-hmm. So we actually assume the council has the same arithmetic, 12.5%, as we do. Okay. But by looking at your portfolio and the experience of the actual portfolio, we lowered the risk. Our risk is high, it's 35%. We lowered it to roughly 26% for the council's portfolio to kind of reflect your actual experience and volatility you've achieved over a 20-year horizon. And by doing that, it changes the compounded annual return from our 7.35 to year 9. And that's just a function of the math.
Okay, so if the math is changing, then I don't understand why the expected return wouldn't also change.
The math didn't change. The math is exactly the same as what we did last year.
You have to come back. Jeremy Shepard, explanation.
Let me interject, sorry. What may be confusing is that it said the Texas return was lowered, but it hasn't been lowered. It has been lowered when Cowen first did the analysis.
2017.
Right, so this is actually, nothing has changed since Cowen last reviewed the capital market assumptions for OPERF.
Okay, I'm not following, and this is a really important point because I remember the PE discussion last year was where we had the differences in expected return and where the PERS board really focused on the differences in setting their returns. So understanding how the PE expected return is calculated and how you can change risk or return that in a way that would not impact the actual total fund expected return is something that's really important. I'm not following. So are you saying that before last year's process, this change was made?
And this was made during last year's process. So there's been no change. Our return assumption, the confusing part about this is what baseline do you use? So let's just so if we just ignore this page for a minute, the assumption for the annual return for your portfolio is the same as ours, 12.5%. What we have changed to accommodate your actual experience is the volatility that we assign to that return.
Okay.
Our volatility is very high. It's 35%. We said that is not really reflective of the way your portfolio has actually behaved over the last 20 years of your investments. So we lowered the risk from 35 to 26. So when you compound that 12.5 at our rate, you get 7.35. When we compound the 12.5 at the OIC assumed standard deviation, you get 9%. That's why yours is higher. That makes sense?
It,
we're compounding it.
Right, I understand that the volatility calculated over the very long term would impact, would explain the difference between the expected return for PE and your model and the one that we have. What I'm not understanding then is why this bullet isn't expressed as a change in volatility rather than a change in expected return.
It is admittedly confusing. What it was trying to say is to show what the premium was over the S&P 500. But what we don't show you on this chart is what our assumption is for the S&P 500, which is why this is confusing. I apologize for that.
Well, it is and isn't confusing because it's like disregard the numbers. The substance of the discussion is what we need to have, which is that in your base model for the average PE portfolio, you have a lower long-term expected return because those portfolios have higher volatility. Am I understanding that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the difference between what our expected PE return is largely driven by the maturity of the portfolio and the experience of the staff in driving it.
Right. And if you look at this orange, kind of reddish dot, it's like a little square there,
mm-hmm.
top.
Mm-hmm.
That's been your actual portfolio experience over the last 14 years that we had data. So you can see your volatility, your actually observed achieved volatility was closer to 15% with a return of over 14. And what we're saying is that our go-forward expectation is kind of splitting the difference on the volatility that you've actually achieved and the volatility that we assume. Ours is that little yellow diamond. So we've moved you in the direction of your actual experience, but not all the way.
So this must be a difficult thing to talk through with the consultant.
And then we're conflating that with the spread over the S&P.
Yeah,
that's
and that's where it gets confusing.
They're really independent.
What's independent?
This notion that our expected return is higher because the volatility assumption is lower. Is separate from the bullet point that says, oh, but the spread relative to the S&P is coming down, or came down a year ago.
So, again, stripping out the numbers, getting to the concept is, it must be that based on the historic performance numbers and staff's opinion, the expected return is higher than Callan's average, and the volatility is lower than Callan's average.
Yes, but at the same time, relative to history, that number
needs to come down, right.
Is at a lower spread to the S&P 500.
Right, I understand, which is a way of saying it's coming down.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so we are gravitating, the orange box is gravitating toward the yellow box just by macro forces, not by changes in competence, and we're trying to figure out how to reflect that in the model.
So, but this is exactly the same as it was last year. We have made no change to this assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Either our assumption or the OIC's assumption are identical to last year.
But it's your assumption that drives the actual expected return number, right? Do you put in the customized number?
Yes.
In the model?
Okay. Yes. The customized, so if you go back to the previous page, we go back to this page four, you see the only two that we kind of customized three, but one is really not customized, and that's the diversifying strategies. that we customize the real assets because we want to reflect a little more of the composition of your actual investments in real assets. And then we just talk through the private equity. So those are the only two we really customize to reflect that, because they're private assets and they're something we can't mark to market. There's something that we look at and try to say, okay, let's have a little bit of a compromise between what we think as a standard assumption and what you would have experienced. So that was a compromise. On diversifying strategies, we just made an assumption of a blend of public market indices, 60% global equity and 40% U.S. fixed. And that's easy to calculate because we already have component parts to that. So that is custom, but it's not really custom.
Yep, and it's a small part of the portfolio, so
yes,
we can disregard that. Alan, I remember last year this discussion about the expected return on the PE portfolio, that you were somewhere between our long-term observed number and the customized number that we came up with Callan. Are you still in between those two dots now in terms of expected return on private equity?
Yes.
Okay.
there is actually a comparison slide. So that may be very hard to read. But if you look at the orange scatter, really, Callan is at the upper end in terms of expected return for private equity. So that is the orange diamond in the top right. PCA is the triangle.
Wait. Callan is orange, the highest. I would have thought it was in the opposite.
The colors are by asset class.
Oh,
so
okay.
This is on my asset class. Right.
Okay.
So the orange diamond is Callan's private equity assumption. The orange triangle is PCA's private equity assumption. Callan certainly has a higher expected return for private equity than PCA, but the risks are about the same ballpark.
Okay, here we come to the art, not science, Alan. So what I hear at a high level is this really important asset class that we think, and this may not be true, John, I understand, we think has contributed more than any other asset class in the last, let's say, 20 years to excess return for us. We are trying to figure out how to model the expected return over the long run, and we're balancing what Callan observes in its larger universe with what we know about our own portfolio. Are we missing something in the thinking about this, or is there something you can help us help add to our understanding of the process?
For the record, Alan Emkin, PCA. For the purpose of today's conversation, since this is not part of an asset liability study, this is really just a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The big decision will be when you do an asset liability study, coming up with the assumptions that go into that model, that could have a meaningful impact on what comes out of the model as part of your decision making. But at this point, and it's important for people in Jan's business and mine to be really humble, there's no evidence that we have any ability to forecast the future. We might be pretty good about the relationship between the asset classes, that bonds will do better than cash, and equities will do better than bonds, and private equity or investment real estate will do better than equities. As long as those fundamental relationships stay relatively constant, what's going to come out of an asset liability is the same whether you have higher returns or low returns, as long as those relationships stay the same. When, in fact, we on Friday discussed investment beliefs, we're going to be discussing private equity and what makes it work and what doesn't work. And what is your belief on private equity? And so putting today's discussion with Friday makes a lot of sense, but it's really not going to have an impact until that goes into an asset liability model and you decide whether or not you're going to change strategic asset allocation. And just a point of reference, the historic risk of private equity is completely understated because it's appraisal-based. It's not based upon what's happening in the market. The assumptions that go into these assume real-world volatility. So whether we use 27% or 36%, you're seeing a level in the teens, less than, in fact, public equity. And the reason for that is it's appraisal-based, it's not market-based. And so the numbers, it's just really important to understand particularly the consultant community, loves to make this more complicated than it needs to be. The key question is, do you expect more out of private equity than you do out of public equity, and then how much? And when you get down to a low enough number, then private equity doesn't work any longer. And there's no reason to pay the fees and the risks associated with an illiquid, expensive asset class unless you assume that you're going to get something greater than public markets at a premium.
Okay, that's an important point. If we could pause there for a second. Janet, did I hear you say that based on your volatility and long-term returns, the number you estimate for expected return in private equity was somewhere in the nines? Did I hear nine something?
Our compound geometric return is highly influenced by our very high standard engagement for all the reasons Alan just highlighted. Okay. That we try to capture a lot of different risks that don't exhibit itself in an existing portfolio. So that's why ours is so much higher than you've observed. So we do show a premium on the arithmetic, so the annual return, so we have a pretty good premium, about 4% or more. But when you get to the compounding is when that spread gets narrower, because we punish private equity a little bit harder for volatility. So that Alan was just saying is what we're trying to show here on this capital market line, is the relationships between risk and return are kind of the fundamental building blocks of this. And what pops out the other end is that as long as we get these relationships right, the premium's right, and the risk's kind of on, you know, close, then you're going to get the same relative allocation. The return is going to change, but the same relative allocation will be in place.
Right, but what I'm getting at, so Alan's point was, one of the decisions you have to make over the long term is, will you get more for illiquidity and for in private assets than you do in listed assets? That's sort of what he's saying. You got to keep checking that.
Yes.
Okay. So in keeping checking that, then what I was trying to ask is, do you see the, in your model, the expected return for private assets, is that delta between public equities and private equities narrowing, and how do we know when we've tripped a point where we really need to ask the question about whether that type of investing is worth it? How do we know that in all these numbers and all the smoke?
Well, it's getting, I think if you just talk to your private equity team, they would tell you that when you get to be a certain size, it gets harder and harder to achieve those higher returns. Plus, there's a lot of capital now in private equity. So that is getting compressed. That spread over the S&P is getting compressed. And the implementation risk in private equity, as you know, is high. You have to be in the best performing partnerships to make this make work against public markets. So that is something you have to monitor constantly. And you know, and so you have lowered your private equity assumption or your private equity allocation back 5 years ago, right, John? When we first got here, we lowered it to 17.5% from 20, I believe. So that was a recognition that once you get to a certain size, it gets harder and harder to achieve that spread. And recognizing that's all net of fees, your public markets have been pretty compelling, and private equity has struggled to keep up in the short run because of that. So if it is a long-term game, you have a long-term performance history, your performance has been terrific in private equity. But you know, that is getting to be more challenging as more capital has come in and the implementation gets more of a struggle, and your size can be an impediment to implementation. So you do have to watch the spread.
So what is it? I haven't heard the number. What's the number that you're
going to... Well, because our expectations for the public markets are going down too.
So
they're going to
come. That's a philosophical question.
Well, I know it's philosophical. I get that it's art, but at some point, I have a really specific question, which is, what is that difference right now? Understanding that it's all an estimate, and we're trying to figure out what it is. The long-term expected return on equities is somewhere between 7 and 7.5. So, what is it on private assets? You can tell me what your Callan number is, not what the.
I'm just going to throw a number out there, but I would guess you would want at least 300 to 400 over to compensate you for the implementation risk and illiquidity over the public market equivalent, like the S&P 500.
Okay, so that's where I want to go, and I have one last question, and I'll let the other people ask questions. So if it's 300 to 400 basis points over, and that bullet on page 8 says we're using 275 instead of 480, it sounds like we're sort of in that zone of thinking about it and questioning it now. Am I right in thinking that way, or am I off in?
Well, I think you're right, but also recall that we had a very compelling presentation from Michael Langdon on February 1st, where he walked you through a detailed plan how we intend to continue to chin the bar at 300. But again, philosophically, what if it's not 300? What if it's 30? What if it's 30 basis points? 30 basis points on $15 billion is a lot of money. So if it's 300 or 275 or 325, you know, I recoil to this idea that private equity hasn't kept up. It hasn't kept up to its historical spread, but it's certainly kept up.
So
you know, as long as it's 10 basis points over private equity on a $15 billion portfolio, that is a lot of money. And that doesn't even consider we all recognize the artificial volatility and the fact that the appraisal process is responsible for that artificial volatility. But there's also a very real impact in Mr. Roden's world that dampening of volatility also dampens the contribution volatility. So there's another benefit to the contribution side. So I just want us to be really clear-eyed and not get hung up on whether that premium is 275 or 325, and if it isn't 300, we should call it a day.
So if I could add one additional commentary to that too, the fear that I have of this discussion of putting an artificial number on private equity is that this 300 number, 400 number, 500 number, however ridiculous you want to get with it, creates a mindset or expectation of a certain level of risk taking you have to take to achieve that. And I don't want to pigeonhole or put us in a box of saying you have to take a certain amount of risk, you have to do this, when in reality the private equity asset class might not be giving you that opportunity set right now. Mm-hmm. So I would, in my own opinion, I would desire to move away from putting too much of a emphasis on the premium.
I agree with that, but we have to focus on something, right? There has to be a rigorous process to ask the questions, to have the inquiry. So if there isn't something that helps us know when to watch it and think about it, what is it? What other option is there?
I think, from my perspective, I think one of the ways that we can do it is, and I think Michael Langdon did it at the last meeting, was presenting from a bottom-up perspective the opportunities he has seen, from a manager perspective, from an allocation perspective, and so on. And as the OIC member on that committee, what I think about is, are the deals that he is talking to me about, the opportunities that, can that achieve a return that is better than equities, and in a return stream that is not exactly the same thing as public equities? Are the returns being generated in a slightly different way? Is it beta, or is it operational efficiency? Is it financial efficiency, and so on? So to me, the strategy is giving you a different return stream, but I think we're trying to model it from a public market perspective. And I feel like that's a bit of a disconnect.
Well, maybe in the context of the conversation on Friday, where we look at a wider array of options, it will seem less binary. But what I don't want us to do is to have the asset allocation process and decision we're making routinized to the point that we're not asking questions about, okay, is this thing that we have rolling working? And I think we need some
especially since it is the lead guitar.
It's lead guitar. Lead guitar has to be on rhythm, right? It has to be on beat. So it has to be, I think, a rigorous conversation, and I don't know how else to frame it except for in a quantitative way to trigger the conversation that won't be purely quantitative. I assume it will be relative and qualitative as well. Yeah.
Not to change the subject, but if I could ask one clarifying question on the capital markets expectations. Actually, I've got two questions. One is a point of clarification, just make sure I understand it. the global equity portfolio of 7.1, I assume that is the geometric coming off of the fact that the volatility is going to be different. Okay. Secondly, the diversifying strategies of 60% global equity, 40% fixed income for a market neutral portfolio doesn't seem appropriate.
And that was the assumption that we generated working with the staff.
Okay.
And that would represent a general footprint. We didn't, since it's so unique, each of these strategies is unique, we had to kind of come up with something that would look approximate that, and we realized that this is not really a great proxy. It's just the best we could do to kind of try to capture that in an asset allocation.
So Rex,
but from a benchmarking perspective, it's not necessarily how we benchmark it.
Yeah, they're benchmarked individually.
Okay, great.
So what would you think? I actually don't know much about what you, do you have an idea of what the what a better comparison would be for that?
Well, I mean, there's no, I mean, the, my understanding of the way that the diversifying strategies is being tried to be built out is without any market exposure. And therefore, using a market beta as its proxy doesn't seem appropriate. I don't necessarily have a solution for it. But
can I just respond to that quickly? Rex, Jim Callahan, challenge is for the record. I'm not sure I would agree that that's what diversifying strategies is.
I think that's the way we're building the
portfolio. Well, I think you're trying to build it out to create a return stream that's different than the rest of the portfolio, not to have market beta. So it's going to have market beta.
Also, why may Steve Callahan, I know there were some additional haircuts or adjustments are made to that 60-40. So the correlations to equities were lowered substantially in the construct. That was what Jason Elliman has said last month. And there were some adjustments to returns as well. So this is less correlated than what the 60-40 would imply. But I think, as Janet said, this was just a starting point for that construct.
No, that's fine. And we don't need to get into a deep discussion about it today. I think there's probably other times we can discuss it. But to just help me to understand the six, how do you get to the 6.2 then?
The assumption for first thing, it's just a blend of those two strategies.
Okay, so we just blended 6% global equity, 40% fixed income, right? But then, at the same time, we lower the correlation under the assumption that the 60-40 doesn't work?
If you look at we actually include, so on this page, we try to highlight some of those issues for us. We try to show what the correlation assumptions are in that table in the bottom.
Yep.
So that's important. And on this chart, we try to show you how the diversification embedded in the entire portfolio reduces the volatility. If you look at the component parts, they're aggregating up. So just on this chart, if you look on the left-hand side, each of these numbers are a contribution to volatility of the total. Total being the bar on the right. So equity being a large part of your portfolio with a high volatility contributes to a substantial amount of total risk at 7.3%. And then you can see private equity contributes some there. It's a lower allocation, that higher volatility. And then if you look at real assets, again, that's a positive contribution to volatility. And you see that for fixed income, that's just a very small amount. So even though it's a fairly large part of your portfolio, it's a very low volatility asset class. So again, contributes a small amount because it's all scale. And the diversifying strategies at 5% is even smaller. So when you bring all those together and look at the correlations of each of those asset classes relative to one another, you get a volatility reduction of 2%. So they don't add up in a linear fashion because you have uncorrelated asset classes under the hood, which is highlighted in the table below, that gives you a lower volatility than if you just add them all together. And that's the diverse, we're trying to illustrate here what that diversification means, and that's the correlation assumptions we make.
No, and I get all of that. I guess my point is a little bit more straightforward. I don't buy the 60-40 concept for the way that my understanding of the way we're trying to build out a diversified portfolio is that it's supposed to be a market control. And a 60-40 benchmark is not market control. And when you combine that with an expected return that is off just a weighted average of a beta while artificially lowering the expected correlation, it seems a bit uneven. So I don't have a solution. I just think that's a discussion that we can have in the future.
once again, it ties directly into Friday, because one of the big things we'll discuss is the difference between the art and the science, and your CIO is heavily leaning on science. This is heavily leaning on art, and I think it's important to recognize how much judgment is used and how many other clients have looked at diversifying strategies. They call them absolute return, and just giving a real return objective as opposed to linking it to any beta or any publicly traded index, recognizing that it's not derived from any of those. But that's a good discussion to have, not necessarily today, but when you revisit asset allocation, what is the role of diversifying strategies and what is a benchmark that's really appropriate? Because I think all of us would agree that 60-40 has nothing to do with the underlying assets.
Just to kind of get us back on schedule, I'm going to skip a couple of these and just highlight some points. So this chart, page 5, just shows you when you bring it all together with all the assumptions that we made, what the expected return is, 7.1, same as last year, risk, same as last year. So this I thought was an interesting chart too that shows how what that volatility, and John, this goes back to the question that you asked, was looking at the volatility of each asset class and what that means when you look at the range of potential returns. So we looked at the current target portfolio, so the total fund on the left-hand side, and equities, private equity, global equity, and you can see at the higher standard deviation, asset classes have a bigger range of returns, and that's all this is supposed to illustrate. And as you move out to fixed income on the far right, you can see the variability in the returns around fixed income because the standard deviation is very low, it's very small. So the more risk, the wider the distribution, the more the risk.
Before you move on,
more variability in the
I just have one quick comment on this slide, but the last comment that after all of the money we're spending on consultants and all the good work that our team is doing here, the odds of hitting our projections are about 50-50.
It's a little less than 50.
Okay. That's what it boils down to, and it correlates with what you said.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to predict what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, and we can only, and that's why it's important to couch all of this in probabilistic terms, is that everything we do looks so precise. And really, it's a range of returns around an expected outcome.
And then maybe we'll talk more about this on Friday. Given that, which I believe is true, one of the charts you're going to come up to soon, or maybe right past it, is that in order to maintain a benchmark of 7.1%, the complexity and the risk to achieve that rate of return has tripled over the last 20 years. And so, you know, a question that's probably for Friday or another time is, what's driving, what are the underlying drivers of our asset allocation strategy? Is it a cash flow projection problem? Is it an assumed risk tolerance of the folks that we're making the asset allocation strategy for, the investments for? Or do we have a actuarial problem? I'm not sure. It's not for today, but I think that's probably part of something we should dive into a little bit more on Friday.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think on Friday that sounds like we should talk a little bit about the PERS specific challenges and then how we connect with that.
Yeah.
And that might help clarify and bring out some conversation about that.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing I would add about this slide, and for our new board members, so the PERS board set the actuarial assumed rate at 7.2. The recommended, or Callan's expected return number was 7.1. They made that decision with a number of estimates for expected return, so it's not exactly the same. So this probability is matching what the PERS board said, not necessarily what the model spit out. They're slightly different, and next year you'll see they're 5 or 6, and there's a huge range of expected return in what they look at.
Yeah, and again, I'm not part of this is ignorance, and I'm not suggesting we're doing anything wrong. I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah.
It was kind of eye-opening to say, all right, we've got a 50-50 chance of hitting any target we're setting out there, and the risk and complexity of our portfolio has grown dramatically over the last 20 years. That just I guess maybe that's intuitive, but seeing the numbers, it's kind of opened my eyes a bit.
That's exactly why we're having the conversation on Friday, to look at how other models face that reality.
Madam Chair, if I may comment, since unfortunately I won't be there on Friday, and Mr. Sherman and I have gone back and forth predominantly last year on this question of really what's the chicken and what's the egg as far as the driver of it. And your comment about the expected return with the volatility attached to it is really a key balance. That's why on the liability side of things, we have a pretty predictable path. Assuming the legislature doesn't make any further changes. But we have a pretty predictable path of what that liability growth is going to be. The variability in all this is the returns. And how and how closely and how closely they match expectations, but also the peaks and valleys and how large they are. So that drives a lot of the cost of the plan, which is all of you know is prominent in public conversation, but we have tried to control for that volatility on the contribution side of the board with their policy on rate collar, which is the mechanic that we've used to control that volatility. Is pretty unique. Our actuaries here, I don't know that it's a common practice among other plans. Usually they do an asset smoothing over 5 or 10 or 15 years. We've decided to do a market-based reporting and then use the collar to control volatility. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, at least in my brain, the responsibility of this committee is on the investment side. There is a prudent level of risk and volatility that a board with this responsibility would assume. I don't know what it is, but there's something there. And I think the consequence of that on the administration side is something the FERS board moderates when it generates the contribution rates that it does. It uses the rate collar to do that. So I am nowhere near eloquent or smart enough to say the pie chart that they put up here shows us how much more volatility we've accepted. I don't know if it's the right level or not. John, that's going to be really more the conversation is I think you can and Ms. Adams is in it as far as Friday goes. But I wouldn't let the consequence of that on the liability side mirror or shade or moderate your conversation. I think you've got to decide and based on your statutory responsibilities and fiduciary responsibilities of what is a prudent investment structure. And then on the administration side, we have to manage what the consequence of that is. Just my 2 cents.
I just want to make sure on this chart that you understand this is an illustration. These are not recommended proposals. These are hypothetical. So you can kind of see, you know, a lot of it has to do with where we are in the rate cycle. Over the last 10-year period, of course, rates have come down. And if you have a fixed income assumption of over 6%, it doesn't take much risk then to get you to 7.1. But if you have a fixed income expectation of 3, then that margin gets much wider and you are forced to take on more risk to get to 7.1. That's all this is meant to illustrate. It's not meant to be a recommended portfolio.
But it makes Member Miller's point.
It's what it is. There's more slices to that pie, and the risk slices have gotten much bigger. We just closed this whole presentation with a couple of pages that I won't go through just to give you some perspective on sort of what Mr. Rodeman was saying, which is, you know, expectations across the public fund universe have come down. This is 170 state and local plans. And you'll see that the frequency of an 8% rate of return assumption is getting, you know, maybe that's 1 or 2. Was much more frequent even, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, or pre-2008 for sure. And you can see that the frequency of the below 7.5 is growing. And then we just split that into inflation assumptions, which you can see have also come down, and real rates of return, which also has come down. Thank you.
And what's the inflation assumption in our, what do you plug into your standard?
Well, we have 2.25, I think ECA has shares that. I don't recall what it's called.
Milliman uses 2.5%.
There you go, so very close. There used to be a big spread between what the consultants assumed over 10 and what the actuaries assumed because they're looking out, you know, 30 years, and they've come much closer together over the last 2 or 3 years.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief because I think the issues were made clear. Every year we come up with new capital market assumptions. Every year I'm humbled by the lack of accuracy in that process. So if you start with that, then you can have an interesting conversation. If you start thinking you really know what you're talking about, you're in a lot of trouble. Where do we start when we did this year's capital market assumptions? We looked at recent history, and equities had done really, really well, and interest rates had risen. And that gets reflected in slightly adjusting our capital market assumptions going forward by a little bit of what we call a haircut on equities because they did so well, and a little bit of an increase in fixed income because interest rates have continued to rise. Now, if 4 months is any indicator, we have the direction right. Interest rates have, in fact, continued to rise, and the equity markets haven't done anything. So it's a really good forecast, except it's 10 years and not 4 months. This has no impact on the asset allocation process. It's just really important to recognize that. It's just a point in time. It will change again in the beginning of next year when we look at what happened in 2018. When it will be meaningful is when you do a full-blown asset liability study. And then you can challenge not just the expected returns, risk, and correlations, which are all assumptions, but you can say, what is the role of assets? And what do we want different assets to do? And are those benchmarks appropriate? And that goes back to Mr. Kim's question, what is the role of diversifying assets? And that's when you get into the guts of that discussion, in my opinion, and you really challenge the status quo. This is just, you're on a highway, you're starting out on the East Coast, you're going to the West Coast, and we haven't even hit Kansas yet. We're still in the middle of the country. Happy to answer any questions on our assumptions, but the only thing I can guarantee you is that they will not be accurate.
Any other questions for Janet, Alan, and Carl?
Carl, if I may, the opening page, the paragraph prior to the staff recommendation, I just have real difficulty understanding it. It's written in English, I know, and I've reread it and reread it, but
this was a change that the council approved last year. So previously, we essentially bundled the policy return or the beta of an asset class with the expected return, excess return premium over it. So beginning of last year, we separated the two. So there is actually now a policy return, the beta, with 7.1% at Cowen via Cowen's CMAs. That's how we arrived at the number. And then the 30 basis points that we get from the excess return target we have for the three asset classes listed listed on the second table.
And so it was controversial at the time, as I remember.
There may have been a robust discussion around it. I don't think there was a lot of there wasn't necessarily like two sides. I think it was more just like a better understanding of why maybe the separation not at all worth distinction. But I think it makes the policy more transparent in terms of what we expect from the market and what we hope to achieve through good manager selection and portfolio construction.
But it said that your excess return declined from 0.4% to 0.3%. Lower active return target public equity.
That's right. So again, this is a very mechanical process where we look at the target allocations for the three asset classes. So if we just highlight public equity, that's 37.5%. And prior to November of last year, the excess return target was 75 basis points. The council approved that the lowering of that down to 50 basis points. as well mathematically by making that adjustment, now the excess return target is 30 basis points.
The active return is subjective, isn't it?
Well, it's relative. So it's relative to the benchmark. So for public equity, the benchmark is the MSCI Global All Cap Index. And the public equity team is trying to generate at least 50 basis points of return over that benchmark. So relative to that benchmark, they're hoping to achieve 50 basis points.
Okay.
Mr. Russell, it's completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no evidence that anyone can always get alpha, and that's an aspirational goal, in my opinion. And that's why it's good to separate the two, because you expect to get the market. You may or may not get the premium.
And that's an important point, because in both and our assumptions, both PCA and Talon's assumptions, we're only within the public markets, we're only looking at market returns, just beta returns. In real estate, in some extent, in real estate and private equity, we do assume some level of implementation added value, right? So that because you can't buy an index for those two asset classes. So especially for private equity because of the implementation. So that's important, that those are beta risks, which is why they tack on a small premium because they're trying, and I agree with that one, those are aspirational goals. And that's what they think they can achieve by deviating from the market.
And it's it is aspirational, but at least, again, just the fact that we look at historical how private equity performed, at least historically, the public equity team has been able to generate, you know, a positive excess return. So it is aspirational, but there at least has been a historical experience of actually been generating some of that. And this may be a good segue just to the staff recommendation at the bottom of the same memo. There's just some minor edits to the two policies for the OIC's consideration.
I really appreciate hearing from each of you, and particularly the combination of your various perspectives and analysis. I wonder, as we transition from this conversation to thinking a little bit about how we'll take this on in a different context on Friday, are there any thoughts you would have as to how we would think about this? How you, having the perspective of lots of different clients and lots of different systems, how you apply these assumptions and perspectives differently in Oregon relative to other places you work? Things we should be thinking about in advance of our Friday conversation.
Well, our capital markets expectations are the same, and they get applied to everyone the same. What your risk tolerance is and what your return expectations are based on the liabilities or the distributions. In the case of endowments and foundations and in a corporate plan, it's completely different because their assets get treated differently. So I'm hopeful that the way that gets presented will pull out those issues, because a lot of the differentiation in those models and the way people deal with it is directly related to how they manage the assets and what the assets are there for. But there are some other things that are common across. So I think that you don't look that much different from other large public funds with a substantial allocation to alternatives and private assets, given the expectations of the returns that you need to achieve to pay benefits. So I think those are things that will come out of some of that conversation, and some of the work that Carl and John have put together on the slides will help highlight some of those differences and how they get applied.
Is it, with a lot of trepidation, let me propose a metaphor. John, your metaphor is the van. I'm a naval architect, so my metaphor is maritime. My view of this is that because of the fact that we have a structural deficit, we're in a rowboat needing to row upstream. And so, the greater the deficit, the harder we need to row. If there weren't a deficit, we would be in a very different circumstance. Is that, John, I'm looking to you, is that an apt metaphor?
I think if there were not an unfunded liability, the asset side would look different.
Yeah.
However, I would not agree that the unfunded liability suggests we need to row harder, faster. I would suggest that we are rowing as hard and as fast as prudently possible. So I've said many times on public record, we can't invest our way out of the unfunded liability. The point Member Miller made earlier that was illuminated by Janet's slide is we have tripled the complexity of the portfolio.
Right.
So my strong opinion is we have done as much as possible, as much as prudently possible, to maintain a level of return that won't grow our way out of the deficit, but hopefully won't exacerbate it. I would say maybe most succinctly, I don't have another gear to go to.
And I just want to underscore that. Again, we had a lot of this conversation a year ago when it was relative to the first force assumed rate. There's the formula that I always start with: benefits equal contributions and earnings, and the earnings are in your purview. And as I said before, you've got to invest prudently. If there is an imbalance in that formula, and there is, to the tune of some $22 billion, that's where contributions have to change, because the Supreme Court has said there's not much you can do on the benefit side. So it is very much filling that hole is certainly, in my view, not the purview of this council. Filling that hole is not what should drive your asset allocation. Prudent investment of a retirement fund is what should drive your asset allocation. And the fact that we have a hole here today should be filled through contributions from employers, because structurally they bear the risk of that investment return. So we lost a bunch of money in 2008. There's a hole that was created, and that hole has to be filled. And it has to come under our current structure from the contributions of employers. So it shouldn't color your, in my opinion, it should not color your investment beliefs or your actions. Those should be that of a prudent investor in a retirement program.
So I look forward to talking more about this concept, John, on Friday, as we look at the other models. What I hear both Director Ruhman and John Sherman saying to us is we've got the risk we can reasonably bear, and we just need to understand how that fits in the larger framework of the plan. Any other questions for our wonderful team?
There still is a staff recommendation for the
So we need to approve the recommendation of for no change in the asset allocation and the expected return number of 7.1.
No, there's some language.
But the recommendation is just regarding some wordsmithing in the policies. So one of the realizations from last year when we separated alpha and beta, again, I would echo some of the other comments that I think that was a real market improvement to our process, and that it elevated the transparency. When I went back this year and read through the two policies that govern asset allocation, it didn't read as crisply as the process we enacted last year, so I made some wordsmithing changes to make it more crisp.
And I think that's page 105 of Director Sisk.
There's two, and one of them, there's just a single line. I think it's only adding two words, and then the other one just makes the concluding statement a little, like I said, a little crisper.
So the staff recommendation is to approve minor changes in OIC Policy 215 and Policy 1203. Is there a motion?
Correct.
Madam Chair, so moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you guys next year for the same dance. We have a short break. We're going to take a 10-minute break. I'll see you back here at 10:25.
This is the
So, Ben, there was a lot of talk about your asset class and expected return model. I just wanted to pull you up to join this session.
Always entertaining. Well, for the record, Ben Mahon, Senior Investment Officer for the Alternatives Portfolio. I'm flanked by the portfolio's consultants, Tom Martin, with Tory Cove. Tory Cove assists on the real asset allocation, infrastructure and natural resource investments, synonymous with the illiquid portions of the portfolio. And Jim Callahan from Callan. Callan assists with the diversifying strategies allocation, synonymous with the liquid allocation, the liquid elements of the portfolio. So per usual, I don't plan to address every page. I have a few bullet points I'd like to highlight, and this is your time, so please don't hesitate to interrupt, which I know you won't. So starting on, I guess I'm driving this, starting on page 2 of the executive summary, the 4 bullets correspond roughly to 4 themes in the portfolio. Is it really loud? Okay. It sounds really loud to me. So you've got role, stage, new faces, and market. As you've heard me say before, the primary objective of the alternatives portfolio is to provide a source of diversification for OPERF, seeking less correlated and diversifying sources of returns as well as inflation-sensitive returns. In this 70s rock band analogy, we play the keyboards with risk and return in between equities and bonds. And in fact, the portfolio was originally sourced 60-40. Second, in terms of pacing, the numbers are in line with expectations. Mr. Sherman mentioned it in his opening remarks, but we reached a key milestone this year. At the end of the year, market value of $5 billion, which translates to a 6.5% allocation, so now over halfway to the 12.5% target. And that continues to grow at the end of March. It was a market value of $5.5 billion and a 7.34% allocation. In terms of stage, the alts portfolio is early in its build-out. Characteristics reflect the stage of development. About 70% of total commitments and capital contributions have been made in the last 3 years. You may recall last year at this time I made almost an identical comment, and that just reflects the growth of the portfolio. So a weighted average age of about 2 years, and that for reference compares to 5 years for the opportunity portfolio, 7 years for the private equity portfolio. The third bullet on here, and the most important, is the additional resources specific to the alternatives portfolio. That's the addition of Paul Koch, investment officer. Later in the presentation, I'll devote a little more time to this topic because it's very important. Also, recruiting for a fourth, and that's in addition to the continued expansion and utilization of the broader OST resources. The last, in terms of market, just to reiterate what John said, it's a very dynamic market with an evolving opportunity set. So it's new strategies, new managers, new structures, and it's never boring. So just to summarize this, portfolio development on track, and I think it's a maritime term, steady as she goes.
I get it.
So moving to page 4, this is a brief background on the alternatives portfolio. The alternatives portfolio is OPERF's newest strategic portfolio allocation. As noted, the portfolio was seeded on July 1st, 2011, with 3 investments from the opportunity portfolio. So now it's nearing its 7th anniversary. Also of note, and consistent with the expansion potential outlined in the original proposal, the target allocation for the portfolio has increased twice since inception, from 5 to 10%, and then from 10 to 12.5%. And lastly, it's a little hard to see on that slide, but there's 3 sectors: infrastructure, natural resources, and diversifying strategies. So I'll pause there if there are any questions before we get to the meat of the presentation.
So, Ben, I forgot to mention when you started that you've done this work for us while you've been on leave.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because you had a baby. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you look well rested. And
that's very generous. Don't look too closely.
Okay. But we're glad you're back and appreciate you putting in the work. I have a basic question on that previous slide. So at the bottom, the performance objective is CPI plus 4, and CPI is 2.1 now? 2.1-ish?
For last year, yes.
Okay. So it's pretty close to what the Callan estimate of a 60-40 portfolio would be. So that was 6.2, Janet, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So even though you have real assets in here, we're sort of circling around the same, same numbers. Okay.
And that's a topic later in the presentation to the benchmark, and something we've had ongoing discussion about that, but a bit of an update on our thinking. So page six, so pages six and seven summarize 2017 in terms of activity. 2017 was a busy year, $2.7 billion in commitments across eight investments. Importantly, in spite of some lumpy commitments, portfolio exposures are balanced and within targets. And as noted, there's been no shortage of deal flow. I'd say the two most important initiatives are on the following page. And this was number one, diversifying strategies. The key project of the year was to advance the ball on the diversifying strategies portfolio build out. And it was really the 2017 was really the culmination of 3 years of work. So very happy with the quality of the process and the strong outcomes. And we're now 85% identified. Second bullet point, additional resources. Again, the addition of Paul Koch, now a team of three, so myself, Mike, and Paul. Paul joins from TIA, which he was responsible for a range of real asset investments and had a resume sort of tailor-made for the position, given his breadth of experience, so was able to hit the ground running and adds a lot of horsepower.
Is he here, Ben?
Should be, yep.
Welcome.
So, yeah, looking forward to introducing you to Paul and Tommy. I feel really good what we can do with a full-strength team. So that the fourth IO recruitment is in progress. And it's worth noting, across the broader alternatives program, the utilization of our analyst pool. So that's Amanda Kingsbury, Eric Messer, and Dana Milliken. It's John Hershey oversees the resource, but they have really grown into become very critical to our work and have quickly have sort of earned the trust of the investment officers to get them involved early and then at a deep level. So that's been a really awesome development. And also so 2018 marks my 10th anniversary with OST, and it's pretty marked. From when I started in 2008, it was an investment division of 20 people. There was no Dave Randall. There was a Dina, but she wasn't dedicated as a director of legal and compliance. And so those groups just continue to expand. Under Carl's leadership, the risk function, the addition of an ESG investment officer later this summer, all really great developments. And just we continue to be lean. It's a lean model, but with a lot more horsepower. Mentioned earlier, the last final bullet point here, the evaluation of the portfolio benchmark. We went through, and this really through the course of 2017, an in-depth evaluation of the benchmark, and there's a slide dedicated to it in the appendix. The punchline is retaining the CPI plus 4 as the policy benchmark. And I'll save that conversation for the appendix for a little more, unless you wanted to. Okay. But that was a robust pace, and it continues. On page 8, this gives a summary of the commitments and market value history. I would just draw your attention to the two lines. The first is the dotted line, which represents the alternatives portfolio target allocation. The second line, the solid black line, represents the alternatives portfolio actual allocation. The first increase, just a note, the first increase occurred relatively early in the portfolio's life cycle when the portfolio was less than 1% of the plan. And so the pace of commitments has accelerated accordingly in the last 3 years. Just those blue bars, again, represent the majority of commitments.
So for the board members, I thought it might be helpful to hover on this page a little bit because you can see the years when we do the asset liability study. John, am I right? The jumps there in 12 and, or no, 14 was the year we did the study, right?
No, you're correct. The big jumps both occur are coincident with asset liability studies.
Okay, so As we go through the next year, you see the increase in 2012 from 5 to 10%. Those big changes in asset allocation take a lot of time to execute. So we're just getting to what the target was in 2012. So as we think about that asset and liability study that we're coming to next year, we also have to think about the human resources that are required to execute on those changes. Am I thinking about that right, John?
Correct. And full employment act.
Glad to hear that.
Well, and there's one other consequence to the dramatic change in the asset allocation as well. The duration on the assets in the portfolio, we're tinkering with those as well, right, Ben? So when we drastically increase the allocation, then you have to hustle to catch up, and that delays the maturity of the portfolio, right? Am I thinking about that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay.
That would have the consequence would be a younger portfolio.
So Ben, on that slide, the fair market value is cumulative.
That's correct.
And the blue, the commitments are not.
Correct. That's just in that calendar year.
How confident are we of the appraisals of fair market value for these?
I want Tom's opinion because he has a longer history in how it's evolved, the accounting standards. It's a mix. There are some aspects where I think we feel very confident. There may be a listed component. There may be a very clear proxy. And there's others where it is truly, an appraisal. What I have observed, appraisals tend to be conservative. You tend to see write-downs earlier when an issue occurs. Investments tend to be written up at the time of exit, the meaningful write-up. So in general, I see conservative bias, but I'll let Tom opine.
Yeah, from an illiquid perspective, I think some of these markets are more mature, established, and have more depth to them. So in the natural resource sector, you tend to have more market-oriented information where you can feel reasonably confident in what's being done from a valuation perspective. I think some of the less liquid, less mature markets in timber and ag land, for example, I think you are relying more on a traditional appraisal approach. I think to Ben's point, you do tend to see conservatism in those. Typically, the structures of those investments don't necessarily incentivize manipulation of short-duration appraisals, and we tend to try and mitigate the incentive to do that when we structure them. So I think we feel reasonably confident that the aggregate evaluations are directionally where they should be.
So page 9 summarizes the cash flow activity since inception. There's a lot of information on the slide, but the message is the same. Activity is as expected. Again, two data points to highlight, just the percentage of contributions made in the last 3 years represent the majority, 74%, and that's what just driving the weighted average age. So page 10. The allocations are well within range. We do, and it wouldn't be unexpected if they were to fall outside of those ranges, just given the lumpiness of some of these commitments, but especially the last few years, the allocations have remained firmly within those ranges. So slide 11 and performance, as heavily caveated today, portfolio is still young, so hard to extract any meaningful results. My subjective comments are, I would say pleased with the results and in line with my expectations. looking at the sector lines, and these are the, this is the performance of those individual sectors across these various trailing periods. I would say infrastructure has demonstrated what we hope to achieve from the sector, sort of that consistent level of return. Natural resources, by our definition, more volatility. You've seen, certainly over the 5 years, the broader sort of commodity landscape down meaningfully, using the price of oil as an example, down 50% over the period. And we're not fully exposed to those commodity prices. There's a variety of strategies and approaches, but that has been a headwind to the strategy. Diversifying strategies. Here, the in the vein of diversification, I think we've been very pleased with, still again young, but if you look at the, in particular, the AQR composite, which represents the vast majority of the assets, since inception, it's been a zero correlation with OPR. So exactly what we're hoping to achieve. The returns reflect some muted volatility, so that these strategies tend to have a volatility target and a Sharpe ratio target. In a period of lower vol, you would expect a lower absolute return, and so that's what we observed. So again, I would say too early to make meaningful conclusions, but pleased with interim results. So looking forward, I'd say the headline here is the robust pace continues. Diversifying strategies focuses on that final 15%, identifying strategies there. In real asset world, it's a very full pipeline. That's the in terms of number of we have a formal sort of watch list designation that's as big as it's ever been. And it's a mix of new relationships and re-ups. I've mentioned three and four here before, but that's really, apart from the blocking and tackling of managing the portfolio, other priorities for this year are enhancing the monitoring and risk management and making sure we onboard effectively. There also is a, for the real asset portion, the Tory Cove agreement ends at the end of this year, so we will be commencing an RFP process imminently.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah.
If I could ask you one quick question. So when you think about the portfolio, when you think about your current resources and the targets and the plans that you outlined just now, is that to get us to our current target, or is that to, and how much more would you need in terms of resources in order to, if we ever wanted to expand this program even further?
Yeah, the plans are to get us to the current target. We've been very, as you know, we've been very intentional about the strategies we've targeted. And again, it's kind of the tenets of low fee, transparent, liquid, intuitive, and that's a pretty small universe. And so I think we've, once we achieve that 5% allocation, to go beyond that would require more resources, because it would involve upping, call it the degrees of difficulty with those strategies.
Thank you.
So I will skip ahead to, I guess, maybe a comment on investment pipeline. Again, it represents a very full pipeline. And it's such a broad opportunity set. I think you should expect, full pipelines. So there's usually, it's less defined, less homogeneous asset class. Do you see that in the strategies?
Ben, you and I have talked about this. There's telecommunications infrastructure. I think it's different than data storage. in my own amateur view, is that that's a really exploding universe. Is that worth breaking out?
It's a great question. We have seen within our diversified managers, telecom has always, I'll describe as telecom, has always been in the opportunity set. I think in the last 2 years, we've seen much greater activity. You've also seen dedicated telecom strategies. So I think within the way we've managed all the sub-portfolios is with an anchor, a set of anchor relationships. Those tend to be multi-sector, global, large, and we've complemented those with sector specialists as we found firms with unique capability. The work has yet to be completed, but there have started to become players in the space. And to your point, the communications infrastructure is unique in just the dramatic growth that you've seen in that sector. If you just look at internet traffic, it went from 100 gigabytes per hour in 1997 to 27,000 gigabytes today. That's a 66% CAGR, so every year growing at 66%. And as you see these rollouts of, as technology improves, and you see the adoption of the next generation technology, 5G is going to be 10 to 50 times faster than 4G. You're going to have 5 to 10 times improved latency. So that the driverless cars, drones, video streaming, the consumption, all this drives demand for wireless. So the towers, the small cells, the distributed antenna systems, and then the wires, the fiber, and it does it all, the data storage needs, data centers.
Well, I would urge you to consider separating data storage out from telecommunications.
It's definitely a sector of interest. I don't know, Tom, is there any other comments?
From a market development and a product formation perspective, data infrastructure is probably the most rapidly growing segment of private infrastructure market right now. But it's the full value chain, you know, not only data centers, but all the fiber and the small cell towers, et cetera. It's truly global. This is a problem everywhere in the world, so there's a lot of capital being formed to prosecute against it. But to Ben's point, it is early in its evolution. And we are actively engaged on multiple fronts to evaluate the most appropriate path forward.
And it's hard. I mean, we see these renewable powers, another example, where there's a pretty tremendous narrative, a need for expansion, but translating that into an attractive investment, somewhat unproven.
I guess my question, Tom, is do you agree that telecommunications and data storage are separable?
We would probably look at that as one holistic market and think about the digital communications value chain from a market mapping perspective, because most of the investment strategies that we're seeing come out now are focused on that whole value chain and not typically just data centers. There are some firms coming out of the real estate industry that have sort of data center-centered strategies. The people that are doing it from an operating perspective, which is where we tend to focus, have a broader lens of the market and take a little bit more, just a different view. So for now, we would look at them together. It could be the case that over time, we might say,
so moving forward, this slide is relatively unchanged from prior iterations. This is sort of the vision of the current envision. I guess the message is we've gone from that vision stage to the planning stage, and now it's really in the execution stage. Just a few words on pacing. That's kind of our expectations. It's always a estimate. Over one calendar year to the next, there'll be a range, but we expect, based on what we can see in the pipeline, $2.5 to $3 billion in commitments. In the comment there is, at current pace, we anticipate reaching that target allocation in about 5 years. So if you, unless there are any questions, I can hit some of the, I alluded to some of the slides in the appendix, so I can address those. Or I'll point you to page 21, and this was an initiative we began in 2016. It was just trying to quantify meeting count, and it was initially one of the responsibilities of data was to comb through calendars and notes and correspond with the IOs to track this accurately. Just trying to capture the, you know, this was just Mike and I in 2017. You know, there were sort of initial reviews, some type of correspondence with 600 plus firms or funds. And I think this is probably consistent across the portfolios and wouldn't, nothing surprising here. It just trying to illustrate that the we do have, one thing we do well is have an understanding of the market. We have an open door policy. We have the benefit of a long track record in private markets, private equity and real estate. And now it's developed, this is about developing pattern recognition, having viewed, you know, many similar investments. So it's the way to get good at meetings is to have a lot of meetings and get the reps in. So it just flows down from, you know, that 600 number to 8 that were ultimately sought for approval. And benchmark evaluation, apologies, this is a wordy slide. The alternatives portfolio has used the CPI plus 4 as its benchmark since inception. And that choice was supported by two primary factors. It represented the most common benchmark among peer pension plans and was deemed appropriate and reflective of both the inflation protection investment objective as well as the risk return. If you look at the where it was sourced, 60-40, CPI plus 4, you know, roughly matches the 60-40 portfolio, which is a return objective. So we wanted to reassess and ask ourselves, is there anything better? And the quick answer is we don't believe so. Public indices, not representative, and peer groups are too nascent to be meaningful at this stage, so you don't get that minimum number of observations to make it meaningful. And it remains commonplace for alternative investments. You know, part of the challenge is these, because infrastructure and natural resources in particular, it's a newer asset class, it's not as well defined as private equity and real estate. You see investors define it differently, include different sub-strategies, different goals across the portfolio. So I took as a real-life example, looking at the placement of a specific infrastructure fund, GIP2, which was at the time the largest infrastructure fund ever raised across our peers, and from my from what we had looking at publicly available documents, CalPERS and Virginia Retirement System includes infrastructure as part of their real asset or their real estate portfolio. Alaska Permanent Fund in its illiquid income bucket, New Mexico in its real return allocation, Florida in its strategic investments portfolio, and Washington as part of its tangible assets program. So a range of, although all those plans share a number of common relationships and objectives, you've got legacy issues, staff and board biases, implementation constraints. So it all leads to a variety of portfolio constructs. And that concludes my comments.
Any questions for the alternatives team?
Quick comment and a question. First of all, it's really been a pleasure to work with you, Ben and John. Looking at the amount of work that you're doing done, that you're getting done, the due diligence is remarkable. So, for me, Bruce, thanks for all you do. Just one question. In the last conversation we had, I thought that you had made a comment about a lack of options, qualified options, for the alternatives components of the portfolio because of the relative newness of this strategy, both for us and other funds like us. Is that true? And if that's true, because I'm seeing that you had 600 opportunities, kind of took seriously, or 169 distinct process. I'd like to understand, out of those 169, if I heard you right, there really are 25 kind of qualified alternatives for to choose from today because of the newness of this strategy. Is that right? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. And it varies by the sector. And so if you look at our approach to diversifying strategies, it's really targeted alternative risk premia expressions and trend following managed features. So in that universe, which is pretty nascent, there are 20 to 25 products that have some, maybe it's an 18-month track record, some level of AUM. It would be institutional. And as you tick down the sectors and subsectors, there's a range. Some more mature, I think energy in particular is a little, has just a longer history. But you look at timber, for example, in any year, there's a handful of funds sort of being raised. So it depends on the sector.
Okay, so given that, that it is a new strategy, kind of a new world that's evolving quickly, and there really are 25 kind of qualified options, do you have any concern at this point in time that about a investment concentration for this component of the portfolio, given the lack of qualified options out there, or not?
I think we're comfortable with the level of concentration. It is definitely, especially in diversifying strategies, there's a large exposure to AQR. To unpack that a little bit, there are three separate strategies. So there are, they do share that common parent, but the individual strategies are actually quite different. So the concentration is in one part by design. That's and it reflects a number of things. We are aware of our resource constraints, so have intentionally kept that relationship budget to 30 ongoing relationships, and that's been consistent. And we have some history that's 30 relationships is what we can adequately support. And there is, frankly, we want to prevent, one way to prevent complexity is to prevent creep. That's creep the number of relationships, creep in the number of strategies, just to be very intentional and specific about the strategies we pursue. So I think we are comfortable with the level of concentration. It is on the high end, but that will, over time, decreases the new strategies fund and as the market expands. So we're never there's always a bench. There's always going to be some level of turnover. It's been a little higher earlier on as we've sort of identified picking our spots and our anchor relationships. But what I observed is sort of 10 to 15% turnover a year. So the average sort of hold period is about 10 years. But you'll always have some level of turnover. So hopefully that answers your question. Best I can.
Well, what's the give? So I would say Ben, Mike, John, with the help of the consulting resources, have done an excellent job of maintaining discipline on underwriting and done an excellent job of maintaining discipline on the relationship budget. So the give has been the time, right, that we're still only halfway there. So if we relax either of those other constraints, underwriting quality or relationship budget, we could have more money in the ground. So that is what we have chosen as to give, is that we'll give on time and maintain our discipline and our quality around underwriting and relationship budget.
And that's where I've seen this support. I think programs can get into trouble if they have a very defined box and they say, we need to fill this box this year. You're forced into investment. And I always tell my guys, we don't have to do any one deal. We don't have to do it. There's nothing. We have to do something, but we don't have to do any one deal.
There's a ton of product and innovation going on the liquid side. And I think that's both a good thing and a challenge. And so the measured approach taken to date, we have leaned in aggressively on newer innovative things when it's met the bar and everybody agreed it was compelling, but we've also leaned back in a lot of cases where we've seen other people lean in pretty heavily, And I think, you know, that is going to pay off over time as some of these foundational blocks can scale with capital ramp.
Any other questions for the alternatives team? Thank you very much for your time. We'll see you next year.
Thank you.
Moving on to item number 7 on the agenda, the State Accident Insurance Fund annual update. Please have a seat before you guys check in with us. So, John, at the last meeting, we were introduced to a new private equity investment officer. Is she in the room today?
No, she's traveling in support of the program.
Okay, at some point we'll meet her. All right.
Madam Chair, Karen Lim for the Record, Director of Capital Markets. On my left, far left, is Carrie Burnett, CEO of State, and Gina Manning, CFO of State. This is their annual update and review and what to expect going forward for State Accident Insurance Fund. And there is no recommendation from OSC staff perspective today. This is for information. As you will hear, there may be some differences or some revisions proposed next year at this time. Today is for review only, and the performance has been good. It reflects really the active component, which is fixed income. It's not always as it appears on that cover page, but it does reflect Western Asset Monitoring Management's positioning over the last, the various periods, annual periods there.
Karen, I wanted to ask you, on your team, do you have an investment officer whose job it is to oversee the safe assets in particular, or are they in with the other assets that are generally managed in fixed income? How does the relationship work?
There's overlap, clearly, with managers between the pension assets, safe assets, and Cummins Pool Fund assets, meaning that Western Asset and Wellington manage similar mandates, not identical, for the pension fund and the Cummins Pool Fund.
Mm-hmm.
Safe is very customized since they are an insurance company, so it's more insurance investment driven.
Right.
Similar processes, not identical staff on the managers. To answer your question, we do it as a group, and historically it's been Tom and myself that have focused on the external managers. That will change at some point later this year. If there are no questions, I'll turn it over to Carrie and Gina.
Well, good morning. We appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. The OIC safe relationship is obviously a very important one, and so we appreciate the opportunity to have this annual check-in. We are not, by the way, we're not going to try to predict the future market returns. We're going to leave that to the folks who are behind us. What we will do is cover what you see there, provide a very brief update on the current state of safe, as well as our financial position. And then just a discussion of a handful of key strategic issues that specifically relate to capital management for us, to give you a sense of kind of how we're running the business and where the capital piece really fits in there. Start by saying that the state of safe is good. Our value proposition is extremely strong as it's ever been, and we continue to get great traction in the marketplace. As reflected by the fact that our market share is 54% right now. If you take out the self-insured market, we're actually considerably higher than that, up around 70%. Some of that is driven by a pricing differential that we have, where if you look on average across the board, we're about 10% cheaper, not in every case, but on average across the board, about 10% cheaper than our primary competitors. We have a very strong safety program, about 70 people who work full-time with employers across the state to identify hazards and to mitigate those hazards. And then we pay very close attention to our service levels, and we believe that we are best in class. And that's not just based on what we say. We take surveys of agents, employers, workers, and others that consistently come in with those results. When it comes to return to work services, we're able to get people back on the job on average quicker than our primary competitors. And we are more timely when it comes to making those initial claims decisions and getting that first check out to injured workers. When we can, we declare a dividend. Our board reviews whether you can and should declare a dividend on an annual basis. This past October-November timeframe, we did hand out a dividend of $120 million that was distributed on a pro rata basis to our policyholders based on premium levels. But then there was an additional $40 million, what we call a safety dividend, that was distributed based on success that employers have had on their loss control, their safety efforts. It's been 8 years in a row of significant dividends for us, 20 in the last 28 years, and we consider this to be an important part of our value proposition. We watch our year-over-year customer retention rate very, very closely, and for quite a number of years now, it's been over 99%, so we think that's an important indicator of what kind of job we're doing. And if you look at the workers' comp system in general, the comp system in Oregon continues to do really quite well. That's reflected in part by what's happening with pure premium rates. And pure premium rates are really a proxy for the frequency and severity of injuries. It really reflects injury costs out there. And of course, everybody's goal is to reduce injury costs. This past January, we saw a pure premium reduction of 14%, which was remarkable, and that's on the heels of the previous January, a 6.6% reduction in pure premium. And if you just add up the last 5 years of reductions, it comes to 38.8%, so another great indication of how the system's performing right now. SAFE's financial model is a little bit unusual, largely because of that first bullet. We price our policies essentially at a loss, and then we use our investment returns to essentially allow us to do that, to subsidize our pricing. So our investment returns and having nice, stable, predictable return on our investment is very important to our kind of overall capital planning and our pricing strategy. We have a $2.7 billion claims reserve. And there are fluctuations to that claims reserve that I'll touch on in a few minutes. But obviously, because of the dollars involved, that has a big impact on us. So overall, our goals with respect to our financial model is to maintain, as I said, stable, predictable pricing. We need to grow our capital base on an annual basis just to stay ahead of basic inflationary pressures. And then when we can, we want to pay a dividend. And that's how we try to run the company in general. So I'm going to pause now, and I'm going to ask Gina to go over her state's financial position, and I'll be back in just a bit.
Okay. We're going to take a high-level look at state's financials. In front of you, you see our balance sheet. And what I want to point out here is that the vast majority of $4.9 billion of our assets are actually invested assets within the oversight of the Oregon Investment Council. That our invested assets are in place to ensure that we have the reserves that claims reserves that Terry touched on. We have support for those claims. We can pay those out into the future. And it's also supporting our capital base of $1.9 billion.
Gina, are the other assets there a cash reserve, or what are the other?
The other assets are just typical insurance type assets created and resold at any point in time are possible to collect money. So they're other than investment related assets. Mm-hmm. Our income statement. What I want to point out here is the fact that our income statement is showing for 2017, kind of in the middle of the page, an underwriting gain of $134 million. What comprises a lot of that gain is actually reserve takedown that we were able to do in 2017. Again, $2.7 billion in claims reserves. Our actuaries reviewed that number, and at year-end, they made the data told them that we could reduce our claims reserve liabilities by $280 million. That flows directly through our income statement. Had we not had that $280 million reduction, we would have seen an underwriting loss. And in normal times, our reserve reduction might be $50 to $80 million. So what happens when we have an underwriting loss is we do rely on our investment income to basically break even at the end of the day. So, but in 2017, we did recognize $172 million in investment income, brought us to investment income before dividends of $306 million. As Carrie mentioned, we did issue a policyholder dividend, a total dividend of $160 million, which brought our net income to $146 million. But again, keep in mind, we would not have been in the place to issue that policyholder dividend had it not been for that reserve takedown we were able to record. Our capital position in the insurance world is called our surplus levels. We began 2017 with a surplus level of $1.6 billion. We add in the net income that we recognized for the year of $146 million. And then we had a substantial increase in our equity portfolio, the market value of that for 2017, probably no surprise to you. That added $117 million to our capital position. So we ended 2017 with a capital surplus balance of $1.9 billion. And when I speak to this number, especially the $117 million unrealized gain, I always want to point out that that was as of 12/31/2017. That number is very different today, and it will be different at year-end 2018.
Maybe different tomorrow.
Exactly. This slide shows our premium growth or decreases in premium, and what it's reflecting here is the impact that the 2007-2008 recession had on state's premium levels. Our premiums are substantially based on policyholder payroll levels, and of course when you go into recession, payrolls decline. We have been steadily increasing since the recession, but our premium levels are flattening now, and part of that is due to the premium rate reductions that Carrie referred to. So we saw an increase of just 2% over 16 to 17, and that number might be flat going into 18, is kind of what we're predicting. This depicts our total investment income. It's comprised of our bond interest, which is in the green there, fairly stable, of course, during coming out of the recession, you know, fixed income rates were low, but we really rely on that bond interest income as part of the asset liability matching. We rely on that to pay our known and future claims. The orange are the realized investment gains that we incur just as our investment managers trade our investments during the normal course of their responsibility. So in 2017, we recorded $172 million in total investment income. But again, the key here is the green bars are what we really rely on to in our pricing and any decisions that we make out into the future. This depicts our capital or surplus level and how it has grown since 2010. The largest impact here is due to our reserve takedown. The other area that impacts this number are the change in unrealized investment gains and losses due to our stock holdings. Let's talk about investments. Safe investment priorities. We want to preserve our capital. Very, very important to us. And in the insurance world, our regulators look at our capital rules very closely. Safe, like most workers' comp companies, we're very conservatively invested. Right now, it's about 90% fixed income, 10% equity. And because of that, or one of the reasons for that, is we look for stable, predictable investment returns. And again, there's that matching concept that you guys have been speaking about throughout the day today. I want to point out also that we are in the midst of some key projects. Carrie's going to touch on those. And we need to make sure that we have a capital level that brings us into the future. What I like to tell people is we want to go into the next recession healthy so that we come out of it healthy. And that's what our capital levels are doing for us today. There's talk about asset allocation studies and asset liability matching. We have been in the practice of having a study conducted about once every 5 years. The last study was conducted in 2013, and that was done by Towers Watson. We are currently in the process of planning for a 2018 study. The involvement, as we costs we plan for the study and conduct the study includes ourselves, Treasury, the Oregon Investment Council, State's Board of Directors, as well as our current investment managers. The study is a typical asset allocation study. We're going to ask the consultants to review our asset allocation. We'll look at our detailed policies, our benchmarks, asset liability matching. We'll look to see, make sure that the consultant that works with us understands the risks that are unique to SAFE as an insurance and really workers' comp company. We want them to understand the accounting implications of different asset allocation mix and portfolios. And then we'll ask if there are opportunities out there. But again, the key here is this process is very much a partnership between SAFE, Treasury, the Oregon Investment Council, and our board, as well as our investment managers.
So, Gina, you're bringing up something I was trying to understand. And I've heard, it's nice to see you again, by the way. What is the current asset allocation policy mix? I'm eyeballing it based on performance, but what are the numbers? 85-15?
It's 85% fixed income, 10% equity, and then we have a 5% allocation to real estate.
Okay. And so the 5-year study is that right?
Yes.
Can we change it?
Yes. So in the studies we've had in the past, really, we haven't seen large changes. They've maybe even been into the details. Is there an asset class that our fixed income managers are not allowed to invest in where there's opportunity there? So we definitely look to them for their assistance as well.
So in the past, has the surplus capital number or growth factored into that decision making? So if surplus gets big, can you take more risk, or how is that connected to decision-making?
Part of the study will be a risk analysis. SAFE does have we set a risk appetite and tolerance statement, and we have our board review that on an annual basis. As an insurance company, we are very conservative, and When I first arrived at SAFE, we had about 20% allocation to equities. And what's difficult is just the volatility that brings to our surplus level. When you are looking at $500 million in equities, that you could reduce your surplus by $500 million in a single year. And also, it's very, very important to maintain that the cash flow that the bonds bring to us. That
yeah, so conservative and increasing, the surplus increasing doesn't necessarily mean that there's more capacity for risk taking.
It will definitely be part of the conversation, but
I'll let Carrie. Yeah, if I can just weigh in on that. you saw a slide that shows the significant step up in our capital and surplus.
Right.
And just go ahead to something here for a second. We maintain a claims reserve of $2.7 billion. Our claims reserve is very large because we've been around for a long time, because workers' comp is a long tail line of insurance. We are required to post a reserve for a claims reserve every time there's a disabling claim. Mm-hmm. The reserve that we post is an estimate of the full value of the claim over the lifetime of the claim, mm-hmm. which means we're in the position of trying to predict. In the lifetime of the claim, as you understand, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be decades. And we have quite a number of claims that have been paying out for a period of 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. So when we make that reserving decision, we have to try to project medical costs out over a very long period of time. And that prediction is very sensitive to that estimate of medical costs. The key variable there is what medical cost escalation will be over time. If you look at the last 6 years, 7 years or so, where you've seen huge increases in our capital and surplus, those correspond to historically low levels of medical cost escalation. So in other words, as Gina mentioned, twice a year we look at our claims reserve to see if we're over-reserved or under-reserved. To a huge extent, what we're doing is we're truing up medical cost inflation based on the decision that we made some years ago when we originally posted the reserve. So over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've been able to take a lot of money out of our claims reserve. And as Gina said, it falls right to our bottom line, and it shows up in our capital reserve. If the worm turns and goes the other way, and medical cost escalation goes back to normal levels, or even exceeds normal levels, then exactly the opposite will occur. We'll have to take money out of capital reserve plus and put it into our claims reserve. So those dollars all show up in our investment portfolio, but the way they're labeled can toggle back and forth between the claims reserve label and the capital and surplus label. One of the things that we need to do is make sure that everybody understands that when you see capital and surplus rising substantially, as it has been, those dollars aren't necessarily just extra dollars that aren't needed. Number one, we use those investment earnings as part of our pricing formula. But number two, it's entirely possible that many of those dollars wind up going back into the claims reserve at some point in the future. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Thank you.
May I ask a follow-on to that, Ms. Manley? I'm trying to relate this to what I know, which is property casualty. And as you probably know, there's two kinds of policies you can buy, an occurrence or a claims made. So if in a claims made policy, if someone makes a claim, your insurance covers it. And but if the claim is made after the policy period, you're not insured. So asbestos, toxic exposure demands that people look for an occurrence policy. Are you in effect doing an insurance, an occurrence policy? In other words, if somebody develops asbestos 20 years later, yeah, are they the employer?
Yes, it's based on the date of injury. Now, you talk about asbestos, and there may be some other kind of environmental hazards, and you get into long-term exposure. Some of the exposure occurred while they were insured. Some of the exposure may have occurred after they were insured with us. So there's always struggle and litigation around those kinds of cases, but essentially it's based on the date of injury.
Good. I mean, good for the employer.
And to make it even more complicated, it's based on the date of injury. You can pay off the claim. The person may become medically stable and stationary, and then a year later, 10 years later, have some sort of a relapse which is connected to the original injury, and we then have responsibility for that claim once again, which is one of the reasons why the claims reserve winds up being as large as it is.
Something I'll just add, we are currently paying on a claim with an injury date, or actually the fatality, and the injury happened in 1944. And the actuaries report to me, and our joke is, we know the actuaries got it wrong. Back in 1944, when they were trying to predict the ultimate cost of the claims, as they knew at that point, we're pretty confident they got that wrong. But what the fatality left behind was a disabled dependent. And that disabled dependent has outlasted those mortality tables, and we're still supporting her.
Here's an example of the AL study from 2004, somewhere around there. One of the results from their consultant, I think it was Charles Watson at the time, duration of their liabilities, which was much longer than previously calculated. So what did that do? That extended, it was recommended to the OIC based on Charles Watson to extend the duration for 10 people for life. So for that period of time, until the next study, the custom benchmark was comprised of a target duration of about 8 years, which was quite a bit longer 15 years ago.
Ah, so the ALM study is both on risk and duration. Okay, interesting.
I wanted to just briefly cover just a few strategic issues that, as I said, relate to kind of our capital planning, and we already got into that a little bit. Gina mentioned our project portfolio. We find ourselves, like a lot of organizations, in a position right now where there's a lot of pent-up demand for some technology upgrades. We're right in the middle of replacing our policy and billing system, a very complex and expensive process. That'll be followed up pretty quickly with a new claim system, finance system, and HR system. We went live on the new learning management system just a few weeks ago, and we also have a new document management system in place, but significant capital needs there. An important component of our project portfolio is what we call the Salem Campus Renovation Project. There's a considerable amount of work that needed to be done on our campus on the south side of downtown Salem. We now have a new headquarters building as part of that campus. We began the move into that building last week and will continue the move in for several weeks to come. It was obviously a major project. Very pleased to say it was on time, on budget, and we're moving forward with it all. We obviously watch the economy very closely, as you do as well. Our business in particular is very sensitive to changes in the economy because of changes to employment rates, payroll, credit collection challenges, and so on. And as you saw from Gina's slide, during the last recession, we lost about 27.5% of our top-line revenue. So it tends to turn our business model very quickly. And plus, any changes, whether positive or negative, in the labor markets tends to have an impact of increasing claims, if you can believe that. So these are trends that we obviously have to watch very carefully. We're a pretty big insurance company. And insurers of our size routinely diversify their risks. SAFE does not diversify its risks. And the reason for that is because under our charter, we're a monoline, monostate entity. And that means we have more exposure that's based on the regional economy, regional disasters, that sort of thing, which in the end requires us to have a greater reserve of capital just in case. We talked about medical cost escalation. I'll jump ahead to PERS. You obviously don't need to hear from us about PERS too much, but there's a piece of this that relates directly to SAFE. And we are a PERS employer, and we share the pain of the increasing PERS assessments. Because we are a relatively large entity, I think it was natural that when the governor appointed her task force last year, that there was some focus on SAFE. And there were some options that were put forward related to SAFE. Not necessarily recommendations, but options, as the task force was charged with providing. One of those was to simply take a portion of SAFE's capital. Another would be that whenever we declared a dividend, to take a portion of that to pay down the PERS unfunded liability. Another was to change SAFE's business model, to have a focus on generating profit, some portion of which would be used to pay down the PERS liability. And then the option of either selling or privatizing SAFE, which is actually an option that the governor took off the table pretty quickly. Just want to stress that any and all of those options would have a significant impact on the way we do business and the people who we serve. It would have an impact on pricing, service levels, dividends, and so on. Much of what we do as an insurer relates to managing our capital levels and managing our risk levels. And that's what drives the decisions that we make relating to pricing or dividends or service levels, whatever it might be. And having a threat, even a small threat, of an arbitrary reduction in capital hanging over our heads makes it very difficult to enter into that kind of long-term planning, as you can imagine. The last thing that we want to see happen, I think that anybody wants to see happen, is for SAFE to be viewed as kind of an ATM machine.
Yeah.
So if the legislature needs some money, that would be a great place to go to find it. We just really want to stress that our capital levels are closely matched to our service levels, our dividend levels, and our pricing levels. There would be impacts accordingly. We are reviewing the option of creating a state-specific per site account. That's something we haven't decided on yet, but obviously that would require a big chunk of capital. We believe that our portion of the PERS unfunded liability is probably somewhere in the 90, 95, maybe $100 million range somewhere. And then finally, there's just a host of market issues that we always have our eyes on from a strategic standpoint that could require investments of capital for us to address. We do think that at some point in the not-too-distant future, particularly with interest rates coming back up, that we're going to see some increased competition from some of the larger national carriers in Oregon. We're in the process of looking for ways to provide the capacity for direct online sales to small businesses. It's something that's becoming much more prevalent in the property and casualty field. Some of our competitors are able to bundle workers' comp coverage with other lines of insurance and other types of services, and we need to be able to look at that as well as a potential opportunity for us. And then finally, in the world of insurance, the availability of large data sets allows for carriers to use advanced analytics and artificial intelligence to help make risk assessment, risk stratification decisions, and that's something that that we obviously need to do as well, which will require some investment of capital for us. And that's the end of our presentation. We'd obviously be happy to respond to any questions or comments you might have.
I have to say that that the insurance presentation is one of the more exciting things here.
I don't think anybody has ever said that.
I think it's really exciting.
The workers' compensation insurance is the most exciting thing out there. And I think all of you in the back of the room should take note of that.
Any other questions for Gina and Gary?
Yeah, just one quick question. So you said your portion of the unfunded liability is about $100
million. There has not been a specific allocation on that for quite a number of years. A rough back-of-the-envelope estimate brings it in somewhere in the 90s, we think. If we were to create a side account, the first thing we would do is work with PERS to specify that number.
Okay. Well, you've got it's relatively accurate.
I'm sorry.
That estimate is relatively accurate. Based on payroll and
We believe so.
Okay. Is that reflected in your liabilities and your balance sheet?
It is not. Our insurance accounting does not allow us at this time to book it as a liability.
I thought that all...
On our GAAP financial statement, it is reflected as a liability.
Okay.
They would have received a valuation report, but that would have been as of December 31, 2016. And that would have given them precisely the assets and liabilities mix and the unfunded liability as of that date. It's obviously been 14, 15, 16 months since then. So that is the most recent information they have that is precise. And then the rest of it is just kind of how did 17's excess earnings affect them individually as an employer? How has their experience changed over that time, if at all? So it's somewhat speculative beyond the valuation they do last time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, moving on to item number 8.
Asset allocation and NAVs. Asset allocation at the end of Q1 2018, I think noteworthy for two reasons. The first time we've had private equity dip below 20% on its way to the 17.5% target, and the first time we've had alternatives go above 7% on its way to 12.5%. Good progress there. Three pictures for the NAVs. And then agenda item number 9, preview of coming attractions. We will add a November date for the committee discussion. Lots of good stuff.
Item number 10, we usually reserve some time for open discussion. Look forward to seeing you on Friday. Any other thoughts while we have the time? The only thing I might add is if the timing on having SafeCom present to us is to underscore that the funds that we manage are a mix of pension liabilities, an endowment model with the Common School Fund, and then an asset and liability matching model with Safe. But $5 billion is it's not chump change. So as we look at the other options for asset allocation, let's remember that we're already doing specific allocation strategies in the fund. Even though we see the numbers aggregated, we already have figured out how to run an endowment model, how to run an ALM model. So that's, I think, your timing is perfect for our strategic meeting on Friday. Are there any other specific, specifically managed funds other than Common School Fund and SAFE?
We have several separate accounts on behalf of the various state agencies. They tend to be short intermediate duration fixed income.
Okay.
And not connected to liabilities.
Okay. Great. Any other comments? Then we will have public comment now. Any public? Oh, Diane. Sorry, that was your cue.
Sorry. My name is Diane Franey, and I am with Rooted Investing in the Emerson Street House. I learned I can't have my name listed in the minutes if I don't get public comment, so you'll be hearing from me every time now for a while. My opinion is always my own. I feel the investing that's happening right now is on its way out. It's on the downside of the productivity curve. Which is some of the discussion that happened today, I think, around private equity. It's hard for me to understand all that. I am trying to work with people who I will call the public servants, who are the majority of people who you're investing for, and they don't understand what people are talking about here. And I think it's imperative on us to get to the point where they can understand how their money is being invested. And I don't know how you do that because I don't understand much of what's going on. It's the work I've done my whole life. And I really give so much credit to this volunteer committee because you really do take the time to understand it and to ask the tough questions. And my hat's off to you for that. But our world is changing. We have a president that runs the country on Twitter. He's clear and concise. He changes his mind regularly. He's making change. You have to look beneath what's going on to see that happening. And I think we still haven't made that change from just yelling at people and saying, "Oh, this is wrong." And when you look beneath what's happening, he's not filling positions. That's a good thing. We need to get rid of some of these bureaucrats. I don't even understand what some of them do. I don't think they understand what they do. So that's changing. He has, no patience with anything that he doesn't understand. Someone says he has to get everything on one page. That sounds good to me. I think I want to see everything on one page, too. So that's a challenge to this group. I think one of the things I would also like to see, I've noticed that companies that you can recognize that are not alternatives and are not private equity, things like AT&T and American Express, Quicken Loans, they distance themselves from the customers. I don't know whether you work with any of these companies. I hate this no reply button. I think that's going to put companies out of business. One of the things I'd like to see this group do, and I will be sending stuff to James Sink so that he can pass it on to people, is go back to the CEO and say, "No, you're going to have an office of the president that looks at the problems that are out there in the community and that people are experiencing. And then you use that for your forward planning. Because if you're not listening to your customers, you're all of a sudden going to be obsolete. And that's happening regularly. And then you're taking value away from my investment." So, other than doing that, that's the work I do. I think lobbyists are out. Certainly President Trump has no patience with them. He's got one talking in this year and one talking in that year, and then he comes out with something because he's a quick decision maker. Everyone says, he's an idiot. And he sounds like one, but because he's trying to weed these things out. So, that's what I have to say. If I can help, I would love to do that. And thank you for all your work and your service.
Thank you, Jim. Any other public comment? also like to say thank you to Jen P., who got us ahead of the schedule, and we're ending the meeting a few minutes early today. Have a great day.